KOSU. I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Announcement of the revenue failure by Oklahoma resulted in the credit agency Standard & Poor's to drop the state's credit rating. S&P says the state's financial position leaves it vulnerable should the regional and national economy slow. Neva, how serious is this?
Well, I think it kind of positions these state officials to, again, kind of press on the point that they think that this is the opportunity to deal with the structural budget problems, the overall revenue questions. And, you know, I think it's interesting because while that gives them an opportunity to kind of double down again on that whole scenario, it's getting the continued pushback by the legislature. So it has some ramifications. Obviously, bonds are being let, I think, this week for Oklahoma on the capital improvements project, the further bonding on that. So there is some implications in terms of the cost factor, but I think it's the bigger picture of where Oklahoma is with respect to the national picture, and we're now lagging behind. And when you look at the numbers, a lot of that really points to, again, the downturn in the energy industry, which everybody likes to pile on until we get into a position like this where we take a negative rating or a down rating from these New York firms.
Ryan.
You know, I think that, you know, Neva's right that it adds credibility to what the state leaders have been saying from the beginning of the session, what people like David Blatt have been saying for a decade now. I mean, the idea that we're just now waking up to this, or that some state officials are just now waking up to this, does seem kind of extraordinary, given that we've been in this structural budget deficit and crisis for going on 10 years now. And, you know, the idea that that this happened, I think that this is where maybe S&P gets it wrong a little bit, is that, you know, they're looking at downturns in the ag market, they're looking at downturns in the oil and gas market, but really Oklahoma's structural budget deficit, our revenue problem that we're dealing with right now, started well before those things began to take a decline. Now those have exacerbated it greatly, and we're seeing the result of that. Now, does this serve as the wake-up call for Oklahoma's legislature to get off of its laurels and start to do something about the structural budget deficit, to do something about the dramatic cuts in services that we're seeing as a result of loss of revenue? I don't think it does. And S&P says that. They say that the odds of that happening this legislative session are low. And frankly, if you can't look at the cut in services in your district and say that's enough to get me to do something about this, to set aside politics and do something about this, I doubt that S&P's rating here is really going to be the thing that
but their rating, push you over. Their rating was a double A minus, but with stable outlook. It wasn't like Finch's double A rating for Oklahoma saying that it was a negative outlook. So those things become somewhat relative. I think the bigger picture is, again, are we talking about not just the revenue component, but the budget side? I mean, are the lawmakers going to make cuts to balance these numbers, or are they going to look at the revenue side and try to go find more revenue? And I think that's where we've got these state officials, the treasurer, the finance secretary, the governor, I mean, saying one thing, but really not getting any support and any real traction from the folks that are ultimately going to pass a budget and put it on her desk. And that's where I think we're going to see a pretty stark divide when it's all said and done.
I mean, to the extent that the outlook is stable, I think that you're right there, that the revenue is there. And then, you know, Ken Miller, the treasurer of Oklahoma, they'll tell you the revenue is there. We're just not getting it. And to the extent that we have a negative outlook by some other rating agencies, I think that what they're saying is that even though the revenue is there, the political will to bring that revenue into the state's coffers and invest
well,
it.
Well, and Oklahoma's GDP, the growth in the last 10 years, in the last 5 years, when you look at those numbers, I mean, they've been good. We've exceeded the national average. So what we see in this downturn, again, is largely a component of the downturn in the energy industry, which, you know, when times are good and all of that money's rolling in, everybody likes to be positive on the energy industry. And then when we see these downturns and the implications and the impact, everybody wants to pile on.
The state Supreme Court is investigating the eligibility of its newest justice, Patrick Weirich, to sit on the bench with them. Attorneys for both sides stated their cases on Wednesday. One of them was Brady Henderson from the ACLU. Ryan, what is the argument here?
Well, the argument is that the Judicial Nominating Commission, and let's be very clear, the Judicial Nominating Commission that was established in Oklahoma after one of the nation's most outrageous Supreme Court scandals in the 1960s, right here in Oklahoma, is an incredibly important body. The idea of judicial independence and the judiciary serving as a co-equal branch of government and the selection of those judges, we could not have a better system in Oklahoma than the JNC and the way that it operates. That said, the JNC is still, the Judicial Nominating Commission, is still bound by the Oklahoma Constitution and what the qualifications for particular justices are. One of those qualifications is that you have to come from and reside in a geographic judicial district. Patrick Weirich alleges that he's from Atoka, Oklahoma, but mountains of evidence suggest otherwise, including inconsistencies in his own application to become a justice before the court. What Justice Weirich and his counsel, Neil Leader, are arguing is that the JNC's decisions are final, that they're unreviewable by anyone. And that could lead to some pretty absurd results. What they're actually saying is that the JNC could put forward a 19-year-old Norwegian national who has a felony on their record and no law degree. And if the governor selects that person to go on the court, that decision is reviewable by no one. That's an absurd result. And I think that as important as the JNC is, it's important to not allow an absurd result like that to go forward, because what that does, what that argument does, is that it opens up the JNC and the court for scrutiny by the legislature, and we certainly don't want that.
Neva?
I think what we see is, you're absolutely correct, Ryan, when you say that the JNC is a very important part of this process, and in place, they did their job. I mean, bottom line, they did a very thorough review of the application process. They ultimately vetted and submitted to the governor three names. The governor then selected one of those. And so I think the Constitution clearly states what the protocol is for the selection of a Supreme Court justice, and they abided by that. So if they said through their process and all of the appropriate measures that were taken that this nominee met the threshold, met the qualifications to be put forward as a justice, and that selection was made, then it should stand. And so I think we've got a clear argument on the interpretation on what the Constitution really says on this, and that's what ultimately I think the Supreme Court's going to have to rule on.
But shouldn't this come down to not the JNC? I mean, they only had the evidence that they had, that this should actually be on Patrick Weirich, who will be sitting on the bench and making judicial choices that, if maybe he didn't say, wasn't completely truthful on like an application, shouldn't that come up?
Absolutely. And that's one, whenever we filed this case, and, I think that, Neil Leader, who retired from the Attorney General's office, has come back to argue this case on behalf of Justice Weirich. I think, he's made some allegations towards us that this is really an attack by the ACLU and our clients on the JNC and the judiciary. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, we did this, and we took no pleasure in filing it. We did this and took this case that no one else was willing to take, because we knew and are champions for a strong, independent judiciary. If the people of Oklahoma can't have confidence that the people that are serving on that bench are there because they met the constitutional qualifications, then the public's confidence in the judiciary is eroded. And it's Patrick Weirich's own, alongside other evidence that if we get to a point where there can be an evidentiary hearing, we would like to see weighed out. But it's Patrick Weirich's own application and the inconsistency of saying, I'm a lifelong resident of Atoka, but I haven't lived in Atoka for the most part, in his entire adult life. Those inconsistencies, I think, need to be borne out.
And I think you have in many folks that become involved in government, you have instances where they are from another place in Oklahoma, but they find themselves living in the metropolitan area where their office is, where they're doing the preponderance of their work and have the most time being spent there. So I don't think this is unprecedented, and I think the argument, when it's all sorted out in front of the court, I would have to surmise that it's still going to be a case where the justice is going to be the justice is going to be seated.
Right. Well, it's not unprecedented. I have to say, if I have had a justice who was supposed to be representing me here in Oklahoma City and he lived in, you know, Kansas.
But to suggest that he has no ties to Atokas, to suggest that somehow, I mean, if we were talking about someone who had never lived someplace or had lived there for 6 months, 25 years ago, but that's not true. This is someone whose family has been there. He has been there. I mean, there's a clear evidentiary trail that I think can be documented, and if it gets into that place in the court where there is that type of hearing, I think much of this will come out and be sorted out, and still I think we'll see the end result, the justice will be seated.
And Ryan, will you be satisfied if they find out, okay, well, he has two residencies and, you know, he still has ties there and everything. Will the ACLU be satisfied with that?
Yeah, if the court comes back, and listen, you know, we've disagreed with this court in the past, and we've agreed with this court in the past. At the end of the day, the prerogative of the court is to say what is and is not constitutional. That's their decision, and we're going to respect that. We do think that it behooves the court to investigate this to its furthest extent so that there's no appearance, not even the idea that there could be somebody unqualified to sit on the court, but the appearance of an unqualified individual on the court. We need to get rid of that appearance of an unqualified justice sitting on the court. Everyone needs to know that the people that are there and meet the constitutional requirements to be there.
The governor is getting the bill to bring the state of Oklahoma in compliance with the 2005 Federal Real ID Act. We're recording this Thursday morning, so she might actually sign it by the time we actually release this. But this reverses a 2007 decision by state lawmakers where they stated they would never comply with the law. Supporters say without it, Oklahomans won't be able to get on commercial flights or enter federal buildings or bases. But opponents call it an invasion of privacy. Neva, this flew through the Capitol very quickly.
And I think it flew through the Capitol finally because lawmakers had, as we talked about last week, had heard from constituency, you know, their constituents back home who said, fix this. We don't want this complicated problem of how it's going to be difficult to travel. And for those folks who don't want to have that type of ID, they made the compromise. I mean, they gave an out. And so I think it's the best situation for something that clearly no one's ever going to totally agree on. So, but there had to be some resolution to it. So wherever people fall down on it, at least we've got it resolved. And they got it. And I think the important thing is they got it taken care of early in the session. So it didn't drag on. I mean, they said they were going to deal with this. They made it one of the first items of business in this session, and I applaud them for doing that.
Ryan.
You know, I think legislators and the governor set an incredibly low political bar for themselves. The governor mentioned this in the State of the State. We knew that this was coming for months before the legislative session even kicked off in February. And so, you know, there's this idea of, boy, we might not be able to get anything else done this legislative session, but we can pass this Real ID bill. The merits of the bill and the idea that it creates a dual system where people don't have to get a compliant license that complies with Real ID and participate in that whole program, the idea there undermines the very impetus for the Real ID Act, which is to have an identification program, a national identification program that has consistency across the union. And so we've created this opt-out so that people can have the convenience of being able to get on a flight or go into a federal building or a military base, but we've undermined the very idea of what the Real ID Act at the national level was supposed to accomplish. Now, at the end of the day, that doesn't mean anything because what the Real ID Act does is it provides a false sense of security while at the very same time enabling the federal government to create this national database. Legislators in Oklahoma haven't done a whole lot here, and if they wanted to do something, then they would be lobbying our federal delegation to repeal the federal Real ID Act altogether.
But after so many years, I mean, certainly if they'd started that in 2007, maybe they could have gotten something done.
And I don't think anyone tried to make this that this was going to be some major piece of legislation that we were going to deal with right up front in this session. It was something that carried on. It's something that everyone had pretty much carved out their stake in it and come up with a compromise that the majority of the lawmakers could live with, and they dealt with it, and now they're moving on. So, I mean, from that standpoint, if they would do that with more pieces of legislation, it actually would be a much better process out there. So I think we need to give them a little credit for tackling a problem and actually getting a result, whether we like the total result or not.
Meanwhile, yesterday was the deadline for bills to be out of committee, and lawmakers were busy this week trying to move their legislation through. I just thought we could talk about any bills which have gone through or any which have died. Ryan, let's start with you.
You know, one that sailed through the House, I mean, through the committee process. You know, this week is committee deadline, not even deadline to get off the floor.
Right, this is just committee.
But a bill that sailed out of committee and off the floor in the House and is already on its way to the Oklahoma Senate is House Bill 1123 by Representative Scott Biggs. And what this bill does is it's a direct attack, an assault on the type of protest and civil resistance that we're seeing become much more common and an exercise of our First Amendment rights. You know, Scott Biggs is a lawyer, and it surprises me the number of lawyers that seem to have forgot or deliberately forget what they learned about the First Amendment in law school. These pieces of legislation, we've seen some general protest bills around the country come up. You know, some as extreme as if you run over protesters in the road, you're not liable for any criminal or civil action that comes out of the result of that, running over a protester. This isn't that extreme, but it's pretty extreme. And it's not a general protest bill. It's targeted to the oil and gas industry. This is really a giveaway to the oil and gas industry to make it almost impossible to chill any sort of speech or protest out there. There are already trespass laws. There are already laws that you can prosecute somebody for or sue somebody for if you break their property or you damage their property. This is extreme. And it says that organizations that may be working with these protesters could be fined up to $100,000 to $1 million. And because this is targeted at one specific industry, one type of protest, one type of political speech, it's very, very constitutionally suspect and would probably be tossed out in court, but not before it chills some important political activity. Legislators should, instead of trying to chill this activity, they should be listening to their constituents. This is a time in American history and Oklahoma history where more and more people are being vocal about their role in the democratic process than we've seen in maybe a generation. So rather than trying to suppress that, they should be listening.
Neva.
Well, I think it's interesting that, as we've talked about this session, the House kind of started out very quickly and really went to work. And so they had a lot more of their bills moving through the process earlier this month, where the Senate kind of racked them up. And this week has been, a situation where many of these committees, they've been having 15 or 20 or 25 bills that they're trying to move through the process. So kind of a typical way it happens as we get to the end of these deadline weeks, and everyone tries to have this fast and furious finish. But I think when you look at the bills that get attention early in the session, they're the bills that the public can kind of get a 30-second sound bite on and get some opinion on, whether it's the vaccination bill, the guns on campus bill. I mean, many of these bills that are not new, they're ones that continue to come up and have received a lot of focus. But really, the process where we are right now, if it gets out of one chamber and moves over, I mean, in many instances, it's with almost an understanding that it's going to die on the other side, and vice versa. So I think we've got a lot of the process still ahead of us. And I think the backdrop to all of this is the fact that the real budget and appropriations process is going very, very slow. And I think that's where we're going to see the situation develop, where we're going to have a long month of May. And I don't think we're going to see much resolution on these budget issues until then.
Oklahoma's own Woody Guthrie made an appearance at the state capitol earlier this week. Local artist Jack Fowler projected an image of the folk singer up on the tarp covering the building during construction. Neva, the state doesn't seem too happy about this.
Well, I mean, it opens a door that where do you close it? I mean, and I think if the safety issue is the real issue, then I think that they've got something that they can hang their hat on and probably be able to sustain stopping that, not just making sure that the electrical voltage where they'd plugged into the first time is not available the second time, but really trying to either develop and make it clear what the process is. If it's a process where you just go get a permit to do it and you can launch something up on the side of a public building in this fashion, I think there's a lot more questions than there are answers right now. So I think it's clear that the local artist who has initiated this seems to be in at least saying things that would indicate that he wants to continue to kind of push this envelope, so we'll see where it goes.
Ryan.
Boy, I couldn't be more proud of my good friend Jack Fowler, Seminole County resident, hails from Seminole County, all the, something in the water down there. but I couldn't be more proud of him. His act of protest here, I think, is in line with the image of the individual that he put on the Capitol, Woody Guthrie. And, you know, the idea that this could create a safety hazard to the construction workers, whether that's legitimate or not, you know, Jack Fowler went back out the next night. He was going to project on another building, not the scaffolding. They had the electrical outlets closed off, or the power shut off to the electrical outlets, as Neva mentioned. He went out last night while we're taping on Thursday. So he went out Wednesday night. And even before he could get kicked off, and he brought a generator out with him, he was going to do the same thing. Highway Patrol officers came up to him and told him to leave or be arrested, and have his, or, and they were going to seize his equipment.
Oh.
And whenever he was inquiring, what are you going to arrest me for? They couldn't tell him. You know, they essentially said, we can't tell you, but you're going to go to jail, and we're going to seize your equipment. That's not how the process works. And we had a staff member at the ACLU earlier this week calling OMES, who had sent the letter or the release saying, you know, we appreciate the act of creativity, but don't do it again because it's prohibited. We've been trying to find out what law or rule or regulation are you using to say that this is prohibited? You don't just get to make these things up. And so I think, you know, moving forward here, we can anticipate, whether it's Jack Fowler or other artists, they're going to be more and more engaged in acts of protest and civil resistance. And some of those are going to not just be acts of civil disobedience, where if there's a punishment, they're willing to take it, but they could be protected under the First Amendment. And we're going to be following up on this from our end and working closely with Jack to ensure that his rights as an artist to communicate a message to the people of Oklahoma are protected.
And I'm going to tag it out saying you don't represent, you know, this doesn't represent ACLU, but if Jack is arrested, will you represent him in what basically could be a violation of the First Amendment?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that, you know, from a First Amendment standpoint, we're not criminal defense lawyers, but we are we are one of the state's foremost champions of the First Amendment. And I've told him that if he gets arrested for this and there is a First Amendment defense to be had, that we'd be willing to move forward
and
with
I
that.
Think hopefully before it gets to that place, we can perhaps see an opportunity for all parties, OMES, Jack Fowler, others that are interested in trying to sit down and determine what is the proper, what are the proper rules and procedures to be able to do what they want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the first step in that, whether it's the Highway Patrol or under the Department of Public Safety or OMES, if there's a law or rule that's being violated right now, they need to tell us what it is so that we can say, all right, is this rule, is it constitutionally suspect, or does it meet constitutional scrutiny?
Or at least give someone an idea of what it is they're doing
Give an
wrong.
Idea of what it is that you're doing wrong. I mean, that's simple due process. You can't arrest somebody and then not tell them what they're doing. So understanding what the current framework is, and then, as Neva said, if that needs to be modified in some way moving forward.
Because it can be a slippery slope otherwise.
Sure.
I mean, to express one's opinion and spray paint it on the side of a public building, I mean, yeah, there's lots of opportunities to kind of move way outside the scope of what we're talking about right here, a very narrow scope.
And also, what do you project up there that could be?
And that is what is, I think that is what is important now, that this has come to the public's attention, that they address it, not let it continue to linger on and become a bigger and bigger problem with so many unanswered questions.
Yeah, but there's always going to be a big difference between spray paint and even sidewalk chalk. You know, we've at the ACLU at the national level, we represented individuals who were prosecuted for under graffiti laws for using sidewalk chalk. It's like, well, that's something that just washes away. Ultimately, we settled in that instance, and there was a resolution, and folks modified rules to meet what we saw as the constitutional requirements. And an even bigger difference whenever you're talking about light rays, especially whenever, you know, a lot of these buildings already have exterior lighting on them. So what's the problem other than the image itself?
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.